You're listening to Episode 0 of Season 11 of the GNU World Order. This is Klaatu, and this is Season 11, Episode 0. Today we're going to talk about Slackware 14.2, about the Pocket Ship, and probably some more stuff like where I've been for the past year. Where on earth have I been? Last season, I will admit freely that it kind of got cut off halfway through. The reason that the previous season got cut halfway through is really I just got surprisingly busy between work and sort of work, sort of helping my girlfriend out with classes and things like that, which actually reaped a very interesting product, and I will talk about that in the future. It's a little stop animation program that I wrote for her classroom, and that has been running fairly smoothly, actually, so it's kind of interesting to write an application. I mean, I've written small applications at my day job at this point that get used for things. Interesting things, really. You know, it's really a fun little gig, none of which I can talk about. But the idea of just going home and writing a little Python, WXPython application, and seeing it actually in use to the point where you're getting bug reports and enhancement requests from 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds, and you get to go on YouTube and see what they've done with your application. It's actually very, very satisfying. It's a unique opportunity. I mean, I get that, obviously, a little bit at work. I wouldn't say to that creative, well, I guess it's somewhat creative, but not in the same way. I certainly get feedback and enhancement requests and things like that for some of the applications that I've written, but this is a lot more fun and a lot just sort of fresh, you know. It's just kind of like really crazy stuff is getting made with this little application. So I'll talk about that in the future. I would talk about it today, but I don't want it to all be about that. So we'll definitely revisit that. For now, that's just going to serve as an excuse. It really did take up a lot of time this previous year. So I got feedback and enhancement requests, I guess, about the podcast itself as well. People did seem to really enjoy the video format, but I think by and large, 100% video cast was overkill, because a lot of you, dear listeners who are right now hearing my voice, didn't see the videos, you know, didn't bother getting the video cast itself, and just went with the audio feed, which is fine. I don't mind that at all. And really, the idea of a video cast for the previous season was born of a couple of things, like I believe I mentioned in the previous season. It's just, number one, people have asked, you know, like, we want to see how you do some stuff, so I figured, okay, video. And the other one was that I wanted to do some video editing, really. I mean, I was getting restless, wanted to edit some video, and what better way to do that than to make video that you then have to edit. So that was all sort of serving its purpose, and it was quite nice. It was a lot of fun. But I do believe that 100% video was just overkill in terms of file size, in terms of my workflow. Uploading it to servers just took forever, and then people would have problems getting the video. And then when I finally was lucky enough to get in with the ScannerDrome podcast people, they were uploading it to YouTube for me, which was super appreciated, and then YouTube for some reason flagged my coffee music and changed it, so that was kind of annoying. Certainly nothing me or ScannerDrome could do about that. But yeah, so I feel like it was a nice try, but I think maybe this season what we'll do instead is I will do screencasts as needed. So if I'm talking about an application and trying to describe to you the screen layout, I won't do that. Instead, I will also video cast, or screencast rather, screen capture, I guess, what I'm looking at, and post that as a video so that you can, if you want to, hunt down the video and follow along. Whereas if it's just me rambling on about random commands or developments in the Linux community or whatever, then in that case I will not screencast and I will not video that. So that's how we'll do that. I think that's a pretty good balance. We'll see how it goes anyway. So we're calling this season 11, even if technically it's not. So we've, you know, in the long and interesting history of New World Order, we've now had a half season. 10 was a half season, but you got lots of video out of it. So in a sense, it was a full season. But yeah, that's not what I had intended. I will admit that is not what I had intended. So I'm back now. And we're calling this season 11. And I think that's plenty of discussion about the show itself. So let's get on with the show. As you may or may not know, Slackware 14.2 has recently been released, and when I say recently, I mean about maybe 3 weeks ago as of the time of this recording. I figured I've done a show on Slackware releases pretty much, I think, ever since I started podcasting. I could be wrong about that. I could have skipped 12.1. I may have been too much of a noob at that point. I think that was the big one that kind of... That was my first, like, Slackware release. I think it was 12.1. It might have been 12.0. Jeez, I don't remember now. Either way, it's been kind of something that I've done. So I wanted to talk about 14.2 again, or rather Slackware again, this time 14.2. And I have to say Slackware 14.2 is, I believe, probably, as I've said before of Slackware, it's basically a lot like 14.1. A lot like 14.1, which, as you know, if you've ever heard me speak of Slackware before, is exactly why I like it. I know it doesn't sound very exciting to say that. I know that, you know, it's much more exciting to sort of rave about the hot new desktop that something has, and the exciting new features, and the outrageous new command line, command that it has, or the horrific new init system that it's using, and just honestly, none of that for Slackware is true, and I have to say that's a great thing. Now it may be somewhat surprising to you to learn that Slackware 14.2 does not have a Qt 5, or I should say it doesn't have KDE 5. So KDE 5 is kind of the thing that's pretty much shipping right now in, I guess we could call them the cutting-edge distribution. Certainly Fedora, if you look at Fedora, and to be fair, you don't get a whole lot more cutting-edge than that, but if you look at Fedora, you've got Plasma 5 desktop on there, and so that's using all Qt 5 and KDE 5 libraries, and it's very attractive. I have to say, it is absolutely gorgeous. It's really, really slick looking. I wouldn't say it's production-ready, and apparently neither would Patrick Volkerding, because it's not in Slackware 14.2. And I have to admit that I approve of this decision. I recently got a laptop to replace my old dying iBook 2004 model, which was running Debian with Fluxbox, and it was doing all right. But the screen sort of developed this sort of outage in the lower left corner, so it's kind of died. So I got a new laptop, which is, I should say, a used laptop, which looks like it's the EliteBook 2540P by HP, just so you know. It's kind of a smallish, almost a netbook-sized laptop, and it's actually quite nice. It came to me with a busted keyboard, so I had to replace that. They shipped me a foreign keyboard on accident when I ordered a new one, but I didn't want to wait, so I just am using that right now, and since I remap the whole thing to Dvorak anyway, it actually doesn't affect me whatsoever. It's also got one of those track points in the middle of the keyboard, which I swore I would never get used to. My gosh, I love it. I don't know how I've lived without it. At this point, I almost feel like I don't even need the trackpad. I feel like I could just have the touch point and then a mouse. But to be fair, there's always going to be that sort of part before the keyboard, sort of the wrist rest, so you might as well have a trackpad. Anyway, I'm digressing. Point being, I got this new laptop, and since Slackware 14.2 hadn't come out yet at the time, this was like maybe a month before Slackware 14.2 came out. So since it wasn't out, and I wanted to put something on this laptop so that I could use it, I figured I would try out something else. So I tried Fedora with Plasma 5. It was beautiful. It was really nice for a while. And you could just tell, like, some parts just were not there yet. I remember an early Fedora mailing list, KDE special interest group Fedora list, was sort of aghast that you couldn't set the clock yourself or something like that from the desktop. Like you could do it obviously through a Unix shell, but you couldn't just do it like by right clicking on the clock or whatever, going to system settings and changing the clock. And it was just like, oh, we didn't program that in yet. So yeah, it wasn't 100% ready. And honestly, my experience, just my experience, anecdotal, take it for what it's worth not a whole lot, but in my experience, it was a little bit crashy, the KDE 5 version that I was using. And it must have been because I eventually switched over to Mageia 5 on this laptop, which now that 14.2 is out, I will probably switch over to Slackware when I get a chance. But to be honest, I just haven't had the time to do that, and that's not super high on my priority list. So who knows? Maybe I'll be doing a Mageia 5 review soon, or 6, I guess, is actually on the way pretty soon here. Either way, Slackware is running on my desktop as always, and it's really nice. 14.2, really nice. KDE 4. I don't know, 14 or something like that, or is that the Linux kernel? It's probably both. Yeah, it's a nice, you know, stable distribution, quite nice. I did a pretty simple upgrade. I back up my home drive, my home partition, which is on its own hard drive. I back that up to my backup server with rdiff-backup. It's a handy little backup utility. You should check it out sometime. I may have mentioned it before, may not have. If not, I'll find out and talk about it, because it is really, really nice. So I use that as my backup solution. So before upgrading my Slackware, I don't follow current anymore. I just stay on stable. So I backed up my home hard drive and did one last backup before committing. And then I just nuked the system drive, which is a 16 gig SSD drive, and reinstalled Slackware on there. And the way that Slackware is doing it now is they have a separate disk for source code and for the operating system itself. So when you download an ISO, I've got my subscription disk on its way, but I obviously could not wait because I mean, not only was I eager to upgrade, I mean, I wasn't that eager, but I was eager. But I also maintain a bunch of packages for slackbuilds.org, so I kind of needed to test those sooner than later. Should have been testing them already, so I needed to upgrade. So I downloaded the ISO from a torrent, and it was only like 3 gigs, maybe, tops, max. Usually it's like 4.7 or whatever the maximum amount a DVD can hold these days. So it was noticeably smaller, which I kind of figured, okay, we must have split source from packages, which indeed is what we had done. So the good news is that the disk download, if you're not after the source code, is smaller. And then, of course, for the one or two things that I do actually recompile on Slackware, which would be socks and mPlayer, you can just go online and grab the source code from the internet. So that's actually quite nice. I like that a lot. I did not mind that whatsoever. So I downloaded the ISO, installed it on my SSD drive, and I did a custom sort of split, which may be overkill, but my SSD drive is 16 gigs, and that's enough, but it's just enough, you know? So you kind of have to bit budget. So for user bin, and user, or rather bin, sbin, user bin, boot, obviously, system essential partitions, or directories rather, like that, I put onto my SSD drive. And I think I'm about at 6 gigs right now, 7 gigs maybe. And all the other stuff under like user local and even user share, I went ahead and put on a standard drive. And I realized that doesn't, you know, a lot of, if I'm putting a bunch of assets not on my SSD drive, I'm losing some of the advantage of having an SSD drive. Primarily, I guess the advantage right now is the boot time and a couple of applications that don't require GUIs and a bunch of assets from my standard drive. But that's, you know, that's good enough. So that's my 16 gig SSD drive, and I've got a 500 SSD drive waiting in the wings, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. So, yeah, so I've got a custom split for the system versus all of the different assets versus my actual home, my home hard drive, which again I had backed up, so I didn't really, nothing happened, nothing bad happened, so I didn't have to restore it. But restoring with RDIF backup is really simple. I really must talk about that sometime if I haven't already. It's a fantastic little backup application. Really, really old, but it's based on solid technology, and it just keeps working. It's really, really nice. Anyway, I digress. So Slackware 14 or Slackware 14.2. Yeah, I booted right to it. Everything was as it was before the boot, pretty much. I mean, like everything down to my menu selections, my custom keyboard shortcuts. You know, just everything was there. So I really didn't have to do setup in that regard. And then I, of course, had to start my installing of my custom packages. So I did that, and that takes a while because I custom compile a lot of stuff. But all in all, the migration, and I add 32-bit libraries now. So that's that takes a little while. But again, not that long. You just kind of you go to Alien Bob's website, you download his multi-lib packages, and you kind of add that to your system, and that's it. I mean, well, that's not it. There are multi-lib packages that replace important system components with 32-bit compatible compiled binaries, and then there are 32-bit libraries that you also have to use. So I mentioned at the beginning here that KDE or Plasma 5 was not included with Slackware. Now, Alien Bob has a bunch of Plasma 5 packages online, but as I've said, I don't really think that that's, in my experience so far, it has not been what I would call production ready. So I have not done that. But since so many applications out there in the wide world are, you know, porting their things over to Qt 5, one does kind of want Qt 5 to be available. And luckily, that's not really hard to do either. I don't know how often you compile from source, dear listener. But I tend to do that a lot. So, you know, you might be a little bit nervous about compiling against, you know, having Qt 4 and 5 on your system. So let me talk about that just a little tiny bit. It's not a big deal, first of all. Linux, I mean, this is the beautiful thing about Linux. It knows of what it speaks. It just really knows how to organize and sort things. And so when you install, you know, you've got Qt 4 libraries on your system, and they're all in user lib 64, not a big deal. And then you drop Qt, did I say Qt 5? I meant Qt 4. And then you install Qt 5, and it goes into user lib 64 as Qt 5 libraries. And they are kept separate, they don't clobber one another. And when you compile, you can either use qmake-qt, which is the default one, or qmake-qt5, which is the one that knows to sort of look to qt5 libraries. And so it's really, really simple. You simply, in your cmake configuration step, and I don't know how much cmake you've done in the past. I know I've done a screencast on it, so you should be at least somewhat familiar with it if you don't use it on a daily basis. But you simply go into your folder, your directory full of code, and you you know, typically the step, the workflow is that you make a build folder. So it's usually make dir build or b or bld or whatever you want to call it. Let's call it build. And then you cd into build, and then you do a cmake, and then whatever your options are for your compilation. And there's CMake is a weird beast because there's a bunch of macros that it runs to configure stuff, and there are other built-in functions So it's you know, I tend to find it, or I used to find it a lot more confusing than make, because I was more used to make. And make, you just do, you typically you do a dot slash configure dash dash options, and it shows you everything you can you could possibly pass to that configure script, and in theory it all works. And that's pretty clear. And with CMake, it was never really clear on how you learn that stuff. And then I found the CMake GUI, and that clarified a lot. But recently, this time around, I discovered that there's something called CCMake. So if you do a CCMake, well, what I do is a CMake, and then I do the options that I'm aware of, like C flags, and you know, whatever else I happen to know is included, if I know anything. C flags is always included. You do the dash C flags or CXS flags or whatever, dash D C flags rather. Or yeah. So that's pretty simple and sort of a given. But after that, you're not really sure what is available to you. So what I do is a CCMake space dot dot, and that looks at the CMake files, which is basically your configure script. So that looks at the CMake files in the directory outside of your build, and it gathers all of the things that it's asking for. So there may be an option, for instance, like, you know, use you know, cute use underscore cute underscore version or something like that, and you'd never know that that even existed. But if you do the CCMake space dot dot dot, then it looks in the previous directory where it, which you know, it uses the CMake lists and stuff like that to figure out what it needs in order to configure itself, and it gives you all of those options. And in fact, it's a nice little in-cursus interface, and it gives you like all the common options, and then you can go to an advanced mode and look at like every possible option ever, even the auto detect stuff. So it's well worth doing that if you're compiling a CMake, you know, a C++ application, which usually uses CMake. If you're doing that, try the CCMake space dot dot to find out all of your dot slash configure equivalent options. So that's what I've been doing, and if you do that, then you can tell applications, as long as they offer you the option, to compile with Qt 5 instead of Qt 4. And then you're compiling Qt 5 applications, even though, oh my gosh, you're running KDE 4. But now you're using Qt 5. It's not that big of a deal, to be honest. It seems like such a mystery to some people, you know? It's like, well, on Linux you can't have two different versions of blah blah blah, or I wouldn't do that if I were you because sometimes it gets confused. And, you know, it's like, no, it doesn't sometimes get confused. You tell it what to do, and then, you know, then it doesn't get confused. I don't know. You know, maybe something gets confused if you don't tell it what you want, but that's very frequently because of some kind of auto detection, which isn't getting confused. It's just auto detecting, you know, 50-50 chance. It's either going to auto detect the one that you do like or the one that you don't like, and today it chose the one that you didn't like, and so you say that it's getting confused. It's not getting confused. It's auto detecting what you have on your system. You just didn't like the one that it detected. So, yeah, not a big deal. If you want to use Qt 5 and on a Qt 4, you know, a quote unquote Qt 4 system, you can do that. It's really, really simple. So that's not been an issue. Another thing that hasn't been an issue, surprisingly, is Pulse Audio. Now, in my Hacker Public Radio interview with Patrick Volkerding, he just randomly sort of explicitly said that he's not interested in Pulse Audio. Like, he has no interest in Pulse Audio, you know, in including Pulse Audio. And the guy is no stranger to audio. I get that he's kind of an audiophile. I mean, he was talking in that interview about editing files down to like the sample or something like that, you know? I mean, it was very, yeah, I get that he kind of hears things pretty well. And so he's, yeah, not interested in Pulse. No one in Slackware was really interested in Pulse. Now, what happened separately in the meantime between 14.1 and 14.2 was, surprise, Bluetooth integrated Pulse Audio, And when I say integrated Pulse Audio, I mean Pulse Audio literally became a hard requirement for Bluetooth. Which, if you think about it, kind of makes sense, because Pulse is kind of a sound server, you could say, and if you're jockeying sound around, then that would be the duties of Pulse, right? Or I should say, it would arguably be the duties of Pulse. So, big scary decision had to be made, and, you know, I mean, it's one of those weird times where you really, really, truly see that sometimes there just is no right answer. Because for me, personally, me, Klaatu, if you'd asked me how important, really, honestly, the entire Bluetooth stack was, I would have said, not at all. Like, I couldn't care less about Bluetooth. I don't use it. I don't like it. I would never use it for a keyboard. Lately, I've been admitting to myself I could probably see myself using it for a mouse. I will confess to you that I kind of have seen it. I could see it being used for a mouse, but or game controller. I'll admit that too. Like, give me a wireless game controller versus a wired game controller. I mean, especially if I'm sitting on the couch playing a video game, which I never do, because as I've told you, I'm too busy. That's not entirely true. I've been playing some video games. But if I'm sitting on the couch with my girlfriend playing video games, then that's gonna, you know, it's certainly more convenient to be wireless, just because otherwise you've got like this wire sort of like stretched across the room to your computer, which is in fact what I've been doing. So yes, I could see using Bluetooth in some cases. But certainly not for a keyboard, and I don't have any need for a Bluetooth headset. That's just not something that I honestly don't even know. I thought they were for cell phones, but apparently some people use them for computers, and if you do that, then you want sound in those headphones, and if you want that, then the Bluetooth stack matters to you, and the fact that Pulse Audio is the thing delivering sound is very important to you over Bluetooth. And so it becomes an important issue for some people, you know, even though you're thinking, well, let's just drop Bluetooth. We just won't do it. We'll just, no Bluetooth. That's fine. We'll just wait for the you know, pulse-free Bluetooth library to come about. And it's not likely that that's going to happen, I don't imagine. I don't think anyone hates Pulse that much anymore. And some people really like Bluetooth. So you kind of have to do it. So, in order to get Bluetooth, Pulse got rolled into the mix, and I'll admit I was a little bit nervous about that, because I do my fair share of audio production, not as much as I'd like lately, but, you know, it's something that I care about, something that I tinker around with. So, that made me a little bit nervous, but to my great surprise, Pulse has not been, I shouldn't say to my great surprise, to my relief. Pulse has not been a big deal at all. It has not gotten in my way at all. It's one of those things where, because I was in at the beginning, when Pulse was first getting released, I have a lot of bad sort of associations with Pulse Audio. And I maintain to this day that certain distributions should not have distributed Pulse when they did. And I maintain to this day that some people should not have been on certain distributions that were the right place for Pulse Audio. So Decoded, what I'm trying to say is that at the time I probably shouldn't have been on Fedora because it was too cutting edge for a noob like me. But it's and they should be shipping Pulse Audio because that's what they do. They do the new technology first. And then distributions like Ubuntu really had no business shipping Pulse as early as they did. They should have been protecting their user base. So a lot of the negative feelings about Pulse should not sort of gotten created in the first place, but they did. And so I have these sort of semi-negative connotations to Pulse Audio, but I don't know whether it's... I mean, I know that it's gotten better, because certainly Pulse exists on this laptop, for instance, with Magia, and it hasn't gotten in the way. So I do know that it has definitely gotten better. And I knew that before this year. I mean, I knew that Pulse wasn't as bad as it had been at the very, very beginning, because I've been using Linux for that long, and I know I've seen it grow and get better. So I knew that, but I'd never had Pulse on my production machine. That was the big, big difference. Like, this is the machine that I was going to be using Jack on. This was the machine that I was going to be doing all of my daily production work on. And how was that going to go? And as I've said, that it's really been it has not been a factor at all. If you told me that the machine had Pulse on it and I didn't know better, I wouldn't believe you. It's just completely transparent. It is absolutely transparent. Now, that being said, it's also transparent the other way. All those magical features that Pulse is supposed to deliver to me, I don't feel like I'm taking advantage of any of them yet. So yes, Pulse is there. It hasn't been bothering me so far. But at the same time, I don't feel like I've done any of the cool, wonderful things that I'm supposed to be able to do with Pulse, which, to be honest, I'm still not entirely clear on. If you're doing cool things with Pulse, let me know. I want to know. I know that you're supposed to be able to do really cool things like throw sound across the house and send sound to other computers and just like do all kinds of cool things with it. But I so far I've not been that adventurous, and certainly my home theater setup or whatever is not it. Well, there is none. I mean, there's just it's me, it's my computer and computer speakers, and that's the extent of my setup. So it's not super fancy. So it may be one of those things where, much like the audio and Bluetooth stuff, like it's just not something that I use, so I can't imagine why it's necessary or why anyone cares about it. But rationally, I understand that some people do, and so I concede that it's just not my thing, but that it's important to some people, and so I just kind of take a step away from it. And sometimes you have to do that, and that's one of those things. So Pulse, yeah, I would say that either Pulse has gotten so good that it's no longer an issue at all, or the Slackware developers just know how to integrate Pulse correctly, and no one else in the world does, which, frankly, I can believe either of those things, both of those things. I wouldn't know which way we're supposed to go on that. It is quite nice the way that they've done it. I don't know, how exactly they've done it. I haven't looked. I just know that it's been working great, and I've not had a single problem with my setup whatsoever. Like, I mean, honestly, for the longest time, I even had my old .asound RC in my home folder. I forgot it. Forgot that it existed. And I kept thinking, while I was installing it, I need to remember to get rid of that .asound RC because that's going to screw things up. And for the longest time, I had that in my home folder. I've removed it since just because it doesn't seem to be necessary anymore. But yeah, it's just, it's, it is really, really smooth. It's really difficult at this point to find anything bad to say about Pulse. Like, if you've got anything bad to say about it, let me know, 'cause so far I'm not seeing the downside to it. But as I've said, I'm also not seeing the benefit either, but it's just a thing. It just seems like, yeah, it's part of the whole sound system of Linux. So that's that. What else about Slackware? Well, Slackware 14.2, of course, has a bunch of new packages in it, and I mean that. Like, it's got certain like libraries and things that I kind of kept forgetting that it had. Random things, things that sort of like you don't even think about them until you've sat around and tried to compile them because they're dependents for, three other packages that you need. So things like I think CairoMM, PangoMM. Little libraries like that, HarfBuzz, ChromaPrint, Raptor, and Raptor 2. No, I think Raptor 2, sorry, and then Raptor is in Slack builds. But anyway, yeah. Oh, I think LXML? Or was that already in there? There was some XML related thing that I remember is now just kind of magically there. I think JSON-C is in there now, I think. Yeah, there are, I could be totally getting everything wrong, but I'm just basing all of this basically off of things that my Slack builds that I maintain used to require external Slackware that I have recently stricken off the list because now they're inside of Slackware. So there are lots of new little library inclusions that were not there before, which again, like in some cases you may never know, and then in other cases, the moment you sit down to compile Chromium web browser or some random, well, Jackrack, for instance, suddenly you will completely notice that you no longer have to worry about that whole chain of dependencies because it's just in Slackware now. That's been kind of nice. And the slackbuild.org site is, of course, going really, really strong. There are lots and lots of great packages available on slackbuilds.org. I guess what I'm trying to say, like as my sum up of the entire situation, is that there has really, probably truly never been a better time to try Slackware. And I know people are still sort of like, oh, Slackware, they don't have package management, and you have to compile stuff, and it's such a pain, it's like so ancient, and it's so arcane. But I'm telling you, especially with all the uproar about sort of people and places and things betraying the Unix philosophy, which I feel at length about in the previous season, so I'm not going to repeat it all here. But with all that uproar, you'd think that the criticism that Slackware is arcane and Unix-like would now have turned into a very sort of glaring feature. I don't really see anyone saying that. It's really bizarre to look out in the Linux news and sort of gossip columns and see people on one hand saying, oh, no one's following the Unix philosophy anymore, and then in another column talking about how arcane and old-fashioned Slackware is because it's just so clunky. Well, this is the Unix philosophy, my friends. This is it. This is what you get when you ask for Unixy Linux. Welcome to it. It's all the benefits of BSD Unix philosophy carried out to the extreme, plus all the benefit of native Linux. There's no Linux compatibility layer that you have to install. It is Linux. So yeah, I'm not clear on the criticisms at this point. I'm really confused. I feel like I'm getting mixed signals. But either way, if you're interested in the Unix philosophy, or if you're interested in complete and utter stability, Slackware is probably a good place to start looking. I'm being completely serious. It is great. Here's what you get with the Slackware, in case you're not clear. You get the Linux kernel. You get a stable release of that. You get a bunch of applications, about 6 gigs worth of applications, maybe 8 gigs. I don't know. I spread my system out, so I'm a little bit unclear of how, what the final size was, but let's say 8 or 9 gigs of applications, give or take. I excluded a couple of things during my install, Vim included. But I digress. You get, that's it, really. That's what you get on Slackware, and then anything else you want, you can download the tree, the build tree of slackbuilds.org, and use any number of front ends, or you can do it manually to build extra packages. It's very analogous to FreeBSD ports, which is very analogous to, well, I guess that's it, really, BSD ports. So rather than going out to a repository to find stuff that people have built for you, you instead take sort of all the infrastructure of the repository and dump it onto your computer. It's not a lot because they're all just text files. You dump them onto your computer, and then when you want an application, you go into that skeletal structure of these build scripts, You pick which one you want to build, and you tell that build script to go out onto the internet and download the source code, and then it builds the package and installs it. And that's the workflow. So it's kind of a, I would say, a pool system rather than a, I guess the repositories is also a pool system, but it's sort of an on-demand service, I guess, is what I would call it. Which, I mean, that's kind of a funny way to say it, because repositories with binary packages is kind of on demand too, because you just say DNF install such and such, and then such and such is on your computer, and it doesn't take that long. Whereas if you have to build something from scratch, it could realistically take a while, depending on the size of the application and the power of your computer. But even so, it's a different philosophy, because instead of someone else or some group of people building stuff for you and then stashing it on a server and sort of waiting for you to come and get it if you ever need it, you instead just take the hard work that they've done minus the building. All the brain power that they had to expend to put into, let's make sure this thing builds correctly. You take that, and when you need the thing, then you make that package. To me, that makes more sense, because yes, I build a lot of stuff. Probably build 100 packages from scratch. And that's a fair amount. But do I need to have 300 packages on someone else's server waiting for me to just grab 100? Or should I just get the build scripts, build my 100, and then I've got them for all the computers in my on my network? I just think it makes more sense. That's the philosophy behind it anyway, whether you agree or not. That's just kind of that's how it's done. And it works, and it's quite nice. And there's a lot more flexibility there too, because of course when I do build things, I love to modify things. I really do. And it's not like a Gentoo style, like, oh, I have to optimize every last optimization flag. I don't care so much about that as much as I care just about, like, well, what codec are you going to include in my FFmpeg? What feature are you going to disable on Jack that I want to be enabled? Which Jack do I want to install, one or two? All these little details that, realistically, on like my laptop, okay, it probably doesn't matter. I can honestly, that's just like right now, my laptop's not my main computer. My main computer is my desktop. It's the one that I take seriously. But when I take it seriously, I want it to be serious. I want to be able to control everything. So that's the benefit of Slackware, I guess. I don't know. If you're interested in stability and in tweaking your setup and getting it exactly as you want it, you should check out Slackware. It is well worth it. 14.2. Grab it, install it, learn to love it. Feel free to use my slackbuilds.org front end called Sport or Slackport, slackermedia.ml/sport. Some time ago, not that long ago actually, I thought it was ages ago, but the last known God, a friend of mine in IRC, pointed out to some logs, some IRC logs, if I recall correctly, and actually revealed to me, or maybe he just looked up the kickstart, I don't remember, but yeah, he pointed out to me that it had actually just been like under a year ago. Either way, there was this project on Kickstarter.com. And it was called the Chip, CHIP. The big deal about the Chip at the time was that, oh my gosh, it's the first $9 computer. The world's first $9 computer. And it was taken, of course, with a picture. The picture of it was taken with a piece of fruit, because if you're doing a small system on a chip board with Linux, you have to refer to fruit. It's an obligation. It can't be raspberries, and it probably shouldn't be any kind of berry, but it must be a fruit. So, that was the big deal. It was going to be $9. It was going to be the world's first $9 computer. And the Kickstarter launched and went through and kind of succeeded. And then, of course, Raspberry Pi Foundation decided to release the Pi Zero at a price point of $5 and probably somewhat stole the chip's thunder in that sense. Although, I think it might have been was it $5 or was it £5? Because if it was £5, it may have been actually $9. Anyway, the chip went ahead anyway. I mean, it didn't stop just because the Zero came out. And since the Zero was so scarce, honestly, the advantage to having another option was significant. So the chip that I decided that kind of got me excited about it. I mean, the $9 aspect was cool, and it could be a Pi-like system for $9 instead of 35 or 50 or whatever it is here in New Zealand. I think it's more like 50. So that seemed pretty cool. But and it had like built-in Wi-Fi and little features like that. So it was kind of cool. But what they really got me with was this idea of the Pocket Chip. The Pocket Chip was a system on a chip, the little board that they were making, the $9 chip computer. But it was going to be attached to this sort of larger circuit board with kind of a little touch screen, about maybe a 2-inch by 4-inch touch screen, maybe 2.5 by 4.5-inch touch screen. And there was going to be a keyboard on it, and a battery mounted on the back. So it was basically I've seen since it described as a hip top, HIPTOP. Not a laptop, not a desktop, not a tablet. It's a chip top. It's a hip top. It's like if you could think about an old-time calculator, like I don't actually know of any, but you know, like the TI-80 is the popular one, is that correct? Someone's really angry right now that I don't know more about calculators, I'm sure, but yeah, let's call it the TI-80. Or even like maybe possibly, I've never seen one in real life, but maybe the Zaris, the Zaris? I'm not sure. Either way, call it 19 centimeters high and 8 centimeters wide, possibly. And maybe, I don't know, let's call it five or six centimeters, like, tall or deep. And this would be the Pocket Chip. And that was going to run, I think, $64 in the end, between the battery, the case, and the screen, and the board, and all the components. I think a monitor adapter came to about $64. So I like to say that the world's first $9 computer cost me $64. I got it just about 3 weeks ago, and I have to say it is amazing. It really is. Again, the chip itself, like the system on a chip part of this thing, the SoC, is not that big of a deal. It is about the size of, I imagine, a Pi Zero. I have not seen a Pi Zero in real life, so I couldn't swear to that, but it is about that size. The nice thing about it is it's got a USB port, a standard size USB port. We'll get back to that later. An audio port, and a micro USB port for charging. It has got a battery pack in the case, which is replaceable because you can open the case. Everything's easy to disassemble. Very simple to just take apart and put back together. It does indeed have a, let's call it like a, I don't know, 5-inch diagonal touchscreen, and a funky little keyboard, which I will admit to not totally loving. I mean, it feels really weird. It's kind of, you know, it's you kind of press the key. I don't know if you can hear that. And they're kind of little press buttons, you know, kind of like, I don't know, almost like something you'd get off of a, uh, on a, on an old toy from like the 80s, you know, to like or the 90s to like, I don't know, play music or something, you know. It's just like a really, really weird sensation, and it doesn't always take. And then the layout of the keyboard is pretty bizarre too. They've got like, yes, they have two shift keys, which I guess is nice. I don't really use shift all that much, but the real bother is that they only have one alt and one control on either side of the keyboard, and both of those keys, of course, I use quite often, and I prefer to have my choice of, you know, I don't want to have to hit, you know, control H, for instance, is really awkward. Is that an H? No, sorry, thinking in. This is okay. So control M, for instance, is awkward because you have to bring your thumb all the way over to the right, control, and then M, so your two thumbs are like right up against each other, pressing this control M, where your left thumb really wants to be over on the other side of the keyboard. So yeah, it's a little bit annoying. The keyboard I do not love, but that's a small price to pay, I guess, for the fact that there is a keyboard. And honestly, so far, the primary use case of this thing is, as I actually had expected, is you kind of stand it up on a table, and it's got this little hole where you just stick a pencil through it, so it becomes like this little stand, which is brilliant to me. And you plug a keyboard into the USB port, and now you've got a fully functional Debian Linux computer with your little keyboard, either your normal keyboard, no need for a mouse because the touch screen is the touch screen, and it's got everything. It's got a terminal with tabs. I don't know which terminal it is, like which terminal emulator it is. I know what shell it is, but I don't know what emulator it is. But yeah, it's got tabs. I imagine it's some version of, you know, RXVT or something like that. And it's got apt, so you can install stuff. There's no rooting it. You already have root. You type in SU and then the password, which by default is chip. Hopefully I haven't changed that and forgotten what I changed it to. That would be annoying. Let's find out. Yeah, I did not. Okay, good. So the root password to this device, if you ever steal it from me, is chip. Until I change it, I guess. So yeah, and then you can do apt install, you know, really whatever. Now, so far I've only apt installed Emacs because, let's face it, that's kind of all one needs. And it's been fantastic. It has been absolutely a pleasure to use. It is a slick little machine. I'm estimating a 4 to 5 hour battery life that with Wi-Fi turned on. I could be underestimating it. It just, I know that it goes on for a long time. I tend to chicken out eventually and plug it in anyway. You know, it's kind of one of those things. I would probably have better data if I was only employed half time, you know, again, and was hanging out in coffee shops all day. I would know exactly how long it lasted then. But now it's just sort of like, yeah, it takes me through an evening. Like, what's the big deal? I mean, it's brilliant. It is really, really cool. It is called the Pocket Chip. You can find it online if you search for Pocket Chip. I think the company that did it was called The Next Big Thing. TNC? No, The Next. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. But anyway, you can't miss it. It's the Pocket Chip. It's the Pocket Chip that was on Kickstarter. Not that big of a deal. Yeah, it is. The Next Big Thing. No, the Next Thing Company. Made by Next Thing Company. In Oakland, California. Oh, yeah. And China. What a shock. So there's GPIO pins so that you can really just light up LEDs and send signals out to motors and all that sort of thing. It's all disassemblable. You can take it apart, you can put it back together, you can decide not to use it as a pocket chip, you know, whatever. It's a very sort of quote unquote maker friendly device. It came with six built-in applications, I think, or five, a terminal, something called Pico 8, which I'd understood was not open source, but now that I'm looking at it, it appears to be open source. I haven't actually hunted down the source code, but it claims to be open source now. Some kind of music program, maybe that was the one that was closed source, I don't know. It's kind of a tracker, really. It looks vaguely familiar. I'm not sure why they didn't just choose, like, Schism Tracker or something, but whatever. A little notepad application, and then a browse file application, which, when I opened the browse file thing, which took me a long time to do, because I was like, well, I don't have any files yet. But the minute I opened it, somehow, and don't even ask me how, somehow I was just like, this looks really familiar. Like almost like PC Man FM. But surely I'm just looking at a file browser and just randomly deciding that it is, you know, one or the other. Turns out, no, it was totally PC Man FM. That's what came by default with this little device, PC Man FM. So it launches as kind of a full screen, you know, window, but it totally, I mean, it's PC Man FM. It's really cool. It's, I don't know why that part got me excited, but it's just, it is cool. It's cool to recognize things and to see open source projects pop up on other open source projects, I guess. And that is the nice thing about this whole thing, is it's all open source and it's all open hardware. I thought, now that I'm saying that, I don't see that Telltale Open Hardware logo. I don't know if they just didn't put that on here or if I am getting things confused. Maybe it's not open hardware. I'm not sure. We'll have to look that one up sometime. Either way, honestly, it's quite a nifty device. They've got a couple of little hard-coded were custom-coded applications like a battery monitor and a power menu and the wireless menu and the settings. It's all pretty basic, and I don't know if they're ever going to update it ever in their life. You know, you just never know with these sorts of things. But it is really cool. It's a neat little device. It's got, you can reflash the chip with a little flashing utility that they provide for all platforms. And yeah, I highly recommend it. It's $64, which, you know, if you look at, like, I don't know, any given Android tablet, it doesn't really compete with that, you know? I mean, like, you can get Android tablets at this point, I think, for like $85 probably if you look around. So it's not necessarily, I don't know, what I would call a smart buy, I guess. But on the other hand, it's a buy that gets you exactly what you're paying for. Whereas when you do an Android tablet, yeah, sure, there are ways around the Androidness, and there are things that you can do to make it more like a proper computer. But to me, that's always felt like you're hacking around on something that you've just paid, you know, $85, $100, $200, whatever you've paid for it. And that just seems like quite a few steps that you shouldn't have to go through. And if you bought the thing in the first place, it should be something that you wanted. You know, it shouldn't be like a starter kit. It should be the thing that you wanted to buy. And this pocket chip, for me, is the thing that I wanted to buy. It's a modular system that can turn into a little laptop device or hip top, whatever you want to call it, laptop device. It can turn into a little server if I want it to be just a web server at home. It, you know, just like a Pi. It can do whatever I want it to. I can install stuff directly onto it. I can plug a keyboard into it, which is a big deal for me. I don't want to use a Bluetooth keyboard for my, you know, tablet or whatever. So yeah, this is the tablet that I've always wanted, or never wanted, really. I never wanted a tablet, but And this is not a tablet, so that's quite refreshing. So get the pocket chip if you're in the market for a non-tablet. It's a very, very cool device. Looks like we're out of time for this episode. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed hearing me rave about how much I love Slackware 14.2 and my new pocket chip, because I do love both of those things. If you want to talk to me or at me, you can usually find me on IRC. That's irc.freenode.net. I'm usually in the channel Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, OpenSource.com, and Slacks. And sometimes Slack Builds as well. Slackbuilds.org, Slack Build Users, I'm not sure. Look around, you'll find me. You can also email me, of course, at klaatu@member.fsf.org, or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. Both of those will get to me. Thank you again for listening, and I will talk to you in 2 weeks. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.